Welcome, everyone, to a very special 1 hour, one decision, one age, one D interview. I am Chris.
And I am Tom.
And well, we're not taking 60 minutes to play a game. We're kind of be taking maybe 60 minutes to talk to our friend here, Dave Proctor from Mighty Yell Studios, game director, game designer, 2023 NYX Gold Award winner. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Chris and Tom. Thank you guys so much. I don't know. I'm happy. I'm good. I'm making chili upstairs.
All right.
So I'm having a good day.
Awesome. Awesome.
Better than the bathroom leak I had this morning. So, you know.
Yeah. These are like very niche home problems. But, you know, my chili's burning my eyes. Your bathroom's leaking. But yeah, no, I'm doing all right.
Well, all right. So hopefully the chili doesn't leak the bathroom as well. But anyway, so moving on here. Dave, how are you doing today? Otherwise, so
yeah, I'm good. I don't know. I've been like, well, I mean, this is a, you know, we're going to talk about Game Pass, but
yeah.
our game, The Big Con, went up on the Epic Game Store for free earlier this week.
Yes.
So if there are fans of this podcast that don't have Game Pass, you can get it there too, yeah. Which is great. But I've just been like, I don't know, watching people kind of react to that. And it's been really lovely. Like our Discord's starting to blow up again. And
nice.
Like just like it did with Game Pass. Like we just get this big influx of people and it's great. I love it.
That's great. Yeah. And I did see an interview that you did, I guess like a year before you released The Big Con, and you guys were working on this since about May of 2017. Is that correct?
Yeah, like, so the game came out on Xbox and PC in 2021. Okay. And we had like initial concept, we're from Ontario, which is a province in Canada that has good government support for video games, which is great. Yeah. So we had like a prototype fund that we were, you know, nicking away at here and there. But like we were just like really slow burning until about 2019 when we were able to get the full game funded, and then go until launch. And then it was in 2020 in at the last PAX that I met Skybound, who was our publisher, and
nice.
And the rest is history.
Okay.
I was present at that 2020 PAX. The PAX that ended PAXes until the world came back to life.
It was a weird vibe because everyone was whispering about how GDC was going to be canceled, and we were all like, what's happening right now? How big
developers had pulled out, like some of the big developers didn't show. It was
like Sony didn't show. The aisles on the PAX floor were massive because they had to make up for all this lost space and stuff. It was weird.
Wow. Well, things are starting to come back, which is great. But you guys are a remote studio too, right? So that how has that been? Like that was since the inception. Like that was the idea. Like we're going to be fully remote. And
yeah. So my old partner's studio, 13 AM Games, which is where I got my start in video games. Also Toronto studio. You know, also something that I co-owned with a bunch of great people. We were in an office, and when I left that company, I was like, I can't afford an office. Starting something brand new, and we just started being remote, and I started looking at office space, and I even got like little hot desk space and stuff like that. And then the pandemic hit, and I'm so glad that I didn't sign a lease for anything, because we would have been screwed. The first year of this being fully remote, or like from when I started 2017, we got our first two employees 2017, 2018. We were remote, and I was like, oh, I'm awful at this. This is so hard. And then the pandemic hit, and I was like, everybody else is also bad at this. And that kind of helped me. And I managed to excel in that moment where I'm like, no, you're supposed to be bad at remote work. Find the things that you're good at and figure out how to do them, you know, at scale. And then, I don't know, that's just who we are now. We see each other, you know, like once a month or every couple months. The reason I'm making chili is that we're having a chili cook-off to celebrate the 7-year anniversary of the company.
Congrats on that.
Great. Thank you. It's been a ride getting to, you know, understand remote work. And I mean, we still might not fully get it.
Hey, but you've released two games, yeah, which is great. That's impressive in that aspect. And now like on Game Pass and now on Epic Game Store. So that's really cool. The Big Con, the game that Tom and I played, is very much a 90s love letter, I would say.
Yeah.
And with that in mind, I was just thinking about if you ever happen to do like a physical release of this game, like in 90s style, it would be 474 3.5 floppies if you did that.
That's great. I didn't know where you were going with this. That's fantastic.
And one CD, just so you're aware.
That's excellent.
Yeah. I think two CDs.
I think I'm not sure what their final install size was. It might have just crested over the original CDR, you know.
Maybe you can overburn.
You might have to overburn, right? Yeah, that's it. Oh, this is some niche stuff that we're talking about here.
I would welcome that physical floppy copy if you ever release it. So just so you know, you have at least one person that's willing to purchase that from you.
Did you see the it was Cyberpunk did on April Fool's? They were doing a 3.5 floppy announcement.
Like, no,
it's like 40,000 3.5 inch floppies.
I did not see that. I was trying to stay away from Twitter and all that stuff during that day. I was like, no.
That's smart. It's smart of you.
What would that weigh?
It has to come to you in a shipping crate, right?
Like you'd be like delivered on a pallet.
Yes.
We are gonna be doing a physical release for Switch and PS4 and PS5. You know, Xbox kind of gets disincluded from these things because of whatever production costs or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's gonna happen later this year, but it is unfortunately on more traditional media.
Yeah.
Boo.
I know.
I'm just saying. If you really want to. There's obviously some influences, and the other thing I learned about you, and I feel like we're kindred spirits in a way, because you were talking about some of your favorite games. You had mentioned Secret of Monkey Island being one of your favorite games. LucasArts was near and dear to my heart, and I'm wearing a 7 Max shirt because that was my favorite point and click adventure game of all time. I play that like at least once a year because it's I love the art and everything. And the fact that game was fully voice acted back then too was just incredible. Secret Monkey Island was as well, but you know, it was just like, it blows my mind.
The third one was Curse was fully voice acted, which was the mind blowing thing. But before that, it was just the pixel art
text. Point and click, right? Yep. I'm assuming, did that kind of influence the Big Con in a way? You're like, you know what? I want to kind of do something similar.
Oh, God, so much.
Yeah.
it's impossible for, I worked on games before. This is the first game that I fully directed and designed and wrote most of, not all of. The story writing was done by Joel Murray, and a lot of our extra quest writing was done by our producer, Yash. But I did kind of the bulk of the kind of main quest line writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, when I sit down to like be like, what is the first game that I'm going to direct feel like? It's going to feel like the thing that made me laugh when I was younger. Like Monkey Island was the first game I ever played that made me laugh.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that games were allowed to do that.
Right.
Like Mario Kart or, Doom or whatever. Like, they're not funny games. they're enjoyable. But like when I'm playing them, at my SNES or my PC, like it's not about the writing. And mm-hmm. there's something about, like, I was a big reader when I was a kid. Escapism, stuff like that. I was a very slow reader, not a great one, but I like the video games that I could read and engage with. I really, really took me. So I wanted to make that. I wanted to go down that road. I wanted to write jokes and plan silly things that would happen in the game. And that's what we did.
Yeah. I really appreciate the option to add the laugh track. That was great.
Good.
That was great.
Yeah.
I definitely turned that on after our first hour, and I was like, oh, okay, this is great. I'm glad.
Turned that on. Yeah. For those that maybe haven't played it yet, it's we have a fully like the Big Con is filmed before a live studio audience, which is actually what it says when you turn on the laugh track. it like actually pops up at the bottom, and every time there's a joke that we think is okay. We put a laugh line in it, and we had to go through the entire game script and be like, all right, that's kind of funny. that's very funny.
Yes. Yeah.
And give like, there's like five different levels of laugh. Plus some cheers and stuff. Yeah. It was so much fun.
Oh, man. What, did you guys actually record that yourselves or you found like files?
Our audio director, Robbie was, he's like, I got this. Let me do this. And he found like a bunch of studio laughs and mixed them together and stuff.
Okay, cool.
I'm curious, how big was the team that worked on the VidCon?
Yeah, I think when we shipped, so like full-time employees, I think 7 or 8. Maybe 7 is probably more accurate. Maybe even less now that I'm sorry. We are now studio of like 11. Things have blended and mixed so much. Sure, we always have a mix of like people in-house and contractors and stuff like that. Like the amount of people that touch that game is well over 20. Whether it be like to come in and help us with porting or to do QA or localization or whatever. Like we had a good sized group of people there. But the core team was 6 or 7 when we finished.
And you started with
We started with 2. Okay. We started with 1. Like this March 13th is our actual anniversary, and then I think May or June is when I left 13 AM, and I think we hired the very first employee who's still with us. Our tech director George in like November of that year or something like that.
Very cool.
That's pretty great.
That's fun. I mean, yeah, and having some like someone along the ride with you this long for 7 years has got to be cool too. So.
It's pretty wild, and like to watch the way that he and I grow. We're both very like good and bad for each other he described us as a an unstoppable force, and he's supposed to be the immovable object, but every once in a while he's like, yeah, we should do that.
It's like, uh-oh.
So we have a good way of combating each other and coming up with something better, and then occasionally we'll just both go nuts and make something really weird, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, finding those moments of weirdness and throwing in there, I mean,
yeah,
like I said, like the I all the influences in this game, the VidCon was great. I don't know, it was just so fun to see all, like, I mean, the game felt like a 90s movie as well, like kind of like that style, and I'm kind of curious if you would ever take the VidCon to a different medium, like say a TV show or like even like a little like YouTube video or something like that.
I'd love it. I'd die. That'd be great.
Yeah.
We always called it the 90s con artist movie that was never made. That's how we actually talked about it in the house. In the video game company, which is in part run out of my house. But we wanted it to be like wanted to feel like a cross-country road trip movie. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I like a lot of, you know, I always loved like con artist movies. I think they're really cool and fun. And you know, like I'm going on like 8 tangents right now. I apologize.
Go for it. Please.
Like the thing that I love about them is that they're like a power fantasy, but they don't necessarily rely on violence. And at Mighty L, we try to make games without violence, or without the player verbs being to like hurt or kill.
Right.
And a great way to make the player feel powerful and smart without relying on violence is stealing, is grifting. So that's why we did it. And I was like, look at all these con artist movies, and they always have these specific tropes. Mm-hmm. And I set out, like, I was like, I want it to be a road trip. I want it to be a cross country story. And I want one specific thing to happen, which I'm not going to spoil on this podcast. And we managed to do both of those things, and everything kind of dropped around it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had a question, and I've been curious about, so where did that desire to make, you know, no hurting, no killing, but stealing is okay, you know, like where was that line for you? Like, where did you come from?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think how to phrase this. There are a lot. I grew up playing Monkey Island and Mortal Kombat. Those are the two that I played a lot of when I was 9 years old. There are people that make very good violent video games, and there's a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And I just think that we can do something different. In part, you know, it's kind of nice to be the studio that's not trying to compete with Mortal Kombat, you know, or anything that is like kind of, I'm going to say more mainstream, not to sound shady, but like something that is like you can go, I can go plug in my Xbox right now and I can play any number of games about violence and killing. Right. So we get to be something a little bit different. But also I think just like societally, it's kind of nice to start pushing for like games that don't ask that of the player. Like if the only way that you think to interact with the world is hurt or kill, like I'm not saying that video games cause people to be violent. There's a lot of studies that say it's quite not the case, and I'm not against violent video games, but I want to provide alternate actions that players can act on. I do believe that that just language of aggression causes divisiveness. Sure. And I think like providing an alternative is a good thing to do. I think we need to do that. And it also feels good. It feels good to not hurt things. Mm. Now, the line about does it feel good to steal things is the fun part about the big con. That's the challenge. We pitched this game to so many people that would publish like any number of games where you would murder somebody.
Right.
And they'd be like, well, this is a bit suspect. You know, this doesn't feel good to steal money from an old lady, but like it's fine to mow somebody down with a chain gun. It happened a lot, like to the point where I was like, this, no one understands the joke that they're telling here. I wanted that question to be part of the challenge of the game and part of the challenge of designing it. So we made it so that there is always multiple people to con, which kind of fit into the other thing that we were doing, which is it's like an open-ended adventure game. It's not like mm-hmm. a linear adventure game. Every level is just a sandbox of people to rip off, and it's up to you kind of who you rip off. But also I wanted you to kind of be grounded in the fact that you're doing this to save your mom's video store. So right. like, yes, you will steal things, but you are doing it for a reason, mm-hmm. and it is an authored reason. I don't give the player the choice to like not steal, because that's the story that we're telling. The story that we're telling is somebody doing this to save a family business.
Yeah, nice. I did appreciate very much that you don't need to pick every single person's pocket in order to finish the level. Because yeah. even very early in the game, and I've talked with Chris about this a couple of times, is you have this, the guy that works at the school, who's clearly like this cool mentor character to your character. And I'm like, I really can't rob this guy. Like, I just can't bring myself to do it. And it was so early in the game. And I was like, this is really well written, that I like already am feeling this so early in the game. And so I didn't steal from that guy, and I was still able to move on from the first level. And,
great.
You know, I did steal from a bunch of other people.
Did you do the he has a little sort of like additional small quest where you can get money from him? Did you do that?
To collect the tennis balls, right?
Yeah.
That's
an example of how we design this. So like you can go up and you can steal $5 from Mr. Del Bianco out of his back pocket, or you can get a tennis ball off the roof and he'll give you $5 for it. But if you try to pickpocket him and you screw up, you cannot do that tennis ball thing because you have made him suspicious of you, which is like my favorite part of this game, is that you can lock yourself out of stuff.
Yeah.
which is, I don't know, fun.
I did do the tennis ball quest, but I also stole money from him, right?
Yeah, there you go. So,
you monster,
and you feel
Chris.
Like a genius, right? You're like, yes, oh yeah, I did all this stuff. There's a small exploit in the second level that we, you know, like it's always risky to go back and patch a game that's been out for a while, because you might push up some other nonsense and wreck it for a bunch of people. But there's a small exploit that people keep coming into our Discord. They're like, I can do this. There's like a taste test challenge for Horm in the second level, which yes. is our fictional canned meat product. Yep. And they're like, I can do this infinitely. And I was like, okay. Like, I shouldn't be able to do that. I was like, well, it looks like you've conned us, is what I say to people in the Discord. And that's how I just don't fix those kinds of bugs, which is great.
Amazing. I know you touched on, like, obviously, this your studio being about, like, nonviolent games and stuff like that. In the past, like, I guess, few years or so, like, have there been any games or stuff like that have really kind of given you like some inspiration and be like, oh cool, like I'm glad that these people are also doing something similar or whatnot?
Oh man, the hardest question in the world is when you like ask someone to think of something specific and then my brain just goes completely empty.
I'm the same way.
Okay. Yeah, what were you saying?
No, I was going to say I could help out a little bit and maybe buy Dave some time.
Please do.
Think about, Chris, we played Venba.
Yep.
which is, you know, about a mother-son relationship and cooking, right? Like, that's an excellent example. What was the game where you have to, like, arrange a whole bunch of stuff?
Oh, A Little to the Left.
A Little to the Left.
Yeah. Jusant.
Jusant. Like, they're actually... Xbox Game Pass is kind of a great place to run into a bunch of games that are not violent, thank goodness. You know, yeah, I mean, there's tons of violent ones there, too.
Which is one of the things that I really like about it. There's like a lot of, you can take a risk on a weirder thing there, which is kind of fun. Yeah. I while you were giving me some time, I wanted to just like open up. I keep all my games that I've played in a software called Playnite, which is like it's like a multi-library tracker, but you can also add stuff manually just to keep track of it. And I'm just looking at games that I've beaten in the last couple of years. Stuff that I love. I mean, obviously the new Monkey Island was a really big and wonderful one. Ooblets is a really fun non-violent game. That game took me in a way that I haven't been taken since like Stardew Valley, where because it's about like running a little farm and getting these what are essentially Pokemon, and to do like cute silly quests for people in a town and just like to be a decent person. It's excellent. It's really fun, but I got really sucked into min-maxing the farming as I always do.
The danger.
I'll come up with some more games as we go, but like Ooblets, Monkey Island, those are big ones for me. I think they're really
Does it tell you your playtime in there?
I have opted not to track that on certain things. I am being very aware of, you know, there's some things I don't want to know.
Yeah. My Nintendo Switch, when I look sometimes at some of the games that I've played, I'm like, oh boy, like this is too many hours.
No, seriously, I'm a guy that doesn't do a ton of I will play something for the amount of time it takes to usually beat it, maybe a little bit extra, and then I like to move on and try something new. Like I don't get super sucked into stuff forever, but things like, you know, if the hooks are right,
like it's pressing like the right buttons,
will just take me, and then I'm gone. I'll come up with some more good recos before the end of the podcast for sure.
So you mentioned Skybound is your publisher for the Big Con. Were they the ones that got you the kind of the connection between Microsoft and getting on Game Pass, or like did you guys have to kind of pitch to them, or how did that work?
No, that's a great question. It is very much like what's the word I'm looking for here? I view the Game Pass decision making committee as like a group of, you know, secret elders, hooded elders sitting on top of a mountain, and like you present them your game and then they will decide, you know, like that's kind of how it is. But Skybound was able to walk in and be like, we've got five games or whatever they did to get us in there, which was really helpful for us. You know, like I think we had a better shot being, you know, chosen, you know, in a group of good company rather than like just trying to pitch ourselves on our own. And that's the nice thing about having a publisher sometimes is that they know the contacts and they can get us in there. Yeah.
Okay. Now, actually, before we got on, Tom and I were kind of curious about that whole thing with now. From what we've understood in previous interviews, there's like a terms of agreement in terms of how long you guys will be on Game Pass and all that stuff. Is that decided by Skybound and Microsoft, or like you guys have any say on that? Or
I think usually and you know, who knows what NDAs I'm breaking, but I think usually it's like a year. I think that's just the base. Like you see games like Descenders like re-up multiple years in a row because they are very loved, and I think they can then negotiate, you know, coming back in. I would love to stay on for another year. We gotta talk to our contacts to see if we can, just because the player feedback has been really lovely. And like getting to know all those new players has been really fun. So if we can do it, I really want to do it. But I think the base contract is a year.
Base contract. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Sorry, I'm just scrolling through this list. Dredge is a non-violent game, I would say, and it's scary as hell, and it's really fun. That's one of the best games I've played in the last 5 years.
Oh wow! Okay.
So that'd be my big recommendation there. Anyways, I'll stop looking at old video games now.
Yeah. No, totally fine. Yeah. And you mentioned you guys are on Epic Game Store. So how does that work? Because like you're on for like a limited time. So did they just kind of like, you know, bring a Brinks truck over and be like, here you go. Here's what you get for staying on for this long or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's a Brinks truck. That's a way to look at it. Yeah. Because they're, you know, same thing with Game Pass. Like they are giving your game away for free.
Right.
To subscribers of the service. So you are being compensated for that on like a kind of bulk rate. And Epic is not a subscription based thing. So they run their giveaways much shorter because their whole play is to bring people into the store. I think it's a good store. I'm not just saying that because they gave us some money. I like the deals on Epic. It's good. I mean, most people will still use Steam forever, but we show up with our game. There's a number that they can offer and we go for it.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So what are like kind of going back, obviously now you guys have done two games now, Big Con and Night in the Attic. And especially with you guys being remote, what is kind of like the loop in terms of developing these kind of games for you guys? Like that's gotta be a challenge.
I mean, we generally work in like 1 week sprints, see how far we can accomplish in that time. We, you know, try to get into a habit of playing the build together a little bit more frequently, but I'll admit like we're not the best at it. Like that's a hard thing, is to have like a stable build and continue to be playing it. Is like the most important thing that you can do is actually get eyes on the game together as a unit. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we set milestones sort of based on requirements. So for us, they're sometimes financial, like we need to get this done before this time so that we can get paid for it, or we need to get this done before this time so that we can put it into a marketing showcase or you know, give this asset to somebody so they can help us out. So we kind of set, you know, what we call fixed internal milestones and just you know, hunker down around them. In general, you know, I won't ever say that we don't do any overtime, because like we do sometimes need to work a little bit longer. The team is pretty good at tracking their hours and kind of taking it back the next day, so we don't like to go into prolonged periods of crunch. I think that's where the problem is. It's just like, hey, we got to get this done this week. Can we borrow a little time from next week? Is sort of how we like to work. And we'll always like rescope and rescale the milestone, because 9 out of 10 times, you know, what you think you're going to deliver is probably too ambitious and doesn't need to be that ambitious. That's sort of the big thing, and you can just peel it back. And I'm also like, I'm a big fan of talking to our partners and being like, hey, you're not going to get this. This thing is not going to be finished. And either they like that or they don't. But like, okay. I'm not gonna throw my team into the grinder for it.
It's like the reverse Peter Molyneux.
It's the reverse Peter Molyneux. That's, I'm going to make a t-shirt with that on it.
Your t-shirts, by the way, your merch are great.
Thank you so much.
I definitely want to get that, the Mighty Yell, like the old MTV logo looking.
Yeah, thing. The Rad Ghost shit. Your audience can go to mightyelmerch.com and at any point during this podcast and after and get all the merch that we do there, and we sell at PAX as well.
It's funny because my wife is Canadian, and she's never, like, MTV was like something new to her. Well, I know Nickelodeon was something that she was like, I have no idea what you're talking about with Nickelodeon. Yeah. And, you know, but like, again, like the influences on the Big Con, I was like, I could see, you know, Doug and all this other stuff, like all these shows from my childhood. I'm like, where that came from. So I was like, huh, okay.
Well, so Doug and Rugrats, I mean, those are big visual touchstones for the Big Con. Like, we wanted it to look like a 90s cartoon.
Yeah.
And you said your wife's Canadian.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. You said your wife's Canadian. Whereabouts?
In Toronto, yeah.
Okay, so then she would know YTV, which is our which is our
much music and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah, but we got MTV very late up here. It's actually like, it makes me sound like a little backwater country. We're like, oh yeah, we didn't get MTV until like 2008. but yeah, I grew up with those same cartoons. It's just like, I didn't have Nickelodeon either. That was something that my cousins in Georgia, I would watch with them, and I was like blown away by.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. And the other thing that blew me away, I happened to fall into the credits, like just go look in the, and then I heard Rockapella, and my mind was blown. I was like, How do they get them? Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego was like my favorite game show of all time. And to hear that group again was just like, whoa, okay. That was amazing.
I'm glad that worked for you. We were really excited about it. We were just pitching band ideas. Like, who could we get to join into this for a weird marketing idea? And my marketing director was like, what about Rockapella? And I laughed so hard. And then we just found them and called them.
Really?
It was wild. Like, we got to negotiate with their manager, who's been like managing bands like Aerosmith for 50 years. It was so strange. But they were really great. That song that you heard, like, if you hire a musician to play, to write a song, it's very expensive. So myself and one of my best friends, who he and I have been in bands for years, we wrote that song along with our composer Dan Rodriguez, and then we recorded it and gave it to Rockapella, and they gave us back within a day. They gave us back a demo, like a perfect demo, and we're like, oh yeah, okay, that, please, we'll do that. And then they got the, you know, he was like, I'll get the guys over next week, and they just came in and they just banged it out in a day. It was amazing. They were so good.
Wow.
Yeah, absolute pleasure to work with.
That's really cool.
Do it again.
Would recommend hiring Rockapella.
Did you guys actually get a chance to meet them in person as well? Or?
I had calls with them over the phone and stuff like that, but it was still like mid COVID. Like, we were. I remember landing when we successfully got the contract signed between them, and I got my first demo from them. I was waiting in line to get my first COVID vaccine. I remember listening to it, standing in a lineup of about 300 people in like a community center here in Toronto. And I'm listening to this never before heard Rockapella song that like 50% of the people in that line probably would care about. And it was great. It was a wild experience.
Oh man, that's so cool. So cool. I'm so glad that you guys got to do that. I guess another thing, you prior to going into game design and all that stuff, you were a big like writer. You went to school for writing and all that stuff. And I had a question in terms of, what is more challenging for you, writing a game design doc or a kind of a run book, so to speak, for a novel?
Man, I don't know. Like, I'm not a huge game design doc guy. We'll do documentation and we'll come up with ideas and stuff like that, but in general, like, you write a document, then you make the game, and the document's out of date within minutes. We'll write like documents on features, just keep them really light, be like, this is what needs to happen for this feature, and you hand it over and that kind of stuff. Anyways, I'm being particular here, but like, if I could extrapolate that to like what's easier to create a story in, like a video game or a book, it is absolutely a book, because a book, I can just, no one has to come up with new words. Words already exist and they do their job. But in video games, you have to make mechanics, you have to make sprites, you have to create everything, you have to create all the words that you need to use, essentially. You have to invent an entirely new language of telling a story, and then you have to do it. And then by the end of it, you throw it away and you start a new game. So you have to come up with an entirely new linguistic system of explaining yourself, which is a wild, like, why we do this, I do not know. It is a wild choice. But, you know, versus a book, I can just sit in a room and write something and it kind of makes sense by the end of it. But I mean, I don't know. Having somebody else play a game that you made is like nothing else in the world.
Yes. Hey, that's really cool to hear about that. And speaking of words, one of the things I thought that was really cool that you guys did, I wish other games steal from you in a good way, is your dialogue system, where you were able to, like, where the words are highlighted, and then that kind of continues the conversation by like, kind of like you kind of diving into that particular word or like and whatnot. Where did the genesis of that idea come from and all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of how you know, it's kind of how Twine and other like interactive fiction softwares work. Like you play a Twine game on itch. This is how it works, but we've never really seen it in a game before. Yeah. And I wanted to, there's a couple things here. I like the mechanics of like building off a conversation. Like you're not just in a lot of conversation systems, person A speaks and then, you know, you are given three options as person B to say, and that doesn't feel like how conversation feels. Mm-hmm. It, you know, versus like when we talk, when I say something to you, you're like, oh, I do that. Like you build off of the things that I said. So we wanted to make it feel a little bit more like traditional conversation, real human talking. And the way to do that, I mean, in the solution that we came up with was like, you know, what we called interruption or you know, digression on like a single word, with choice words we called them. And that makes it feel like you're actually talking about something. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, it gives the player a choice. And we teach them very early on that you will get two options and you can't go back and pick both. And that is what the game is about. Yeah. So if you start thinking, oh no, I only have one chance to pick these two things, I'm going to do it. Then you're maybe going to start thinking about that in general with your other choices.
Yeah.
So it served like almost a mechanical thematic purpose as well. Which is why I think it's so much fun.
Yeah. One other game that made me think about that kind of did something similar, but and if you haven't tried it, give it a chance, is Pentiment by Obsidian.
Still haven't played Pentiment. Yeah.
It is really good. It is like the art style and everything is just really well done. And yeah, like the way that they interact with the text, it's a lot of reading in that game.
Yeah.
So get ready, but it is.
Hey, I'm here for it.
But it's so well done, and they kind of play with the words like that. But it's nothing like where you kind of dive into that particular like that word, but things get like highlighted in a particular way as well. So that's what your game reminded me of well. So
that's a good that's a strong vote of confidence. Thank you very much. Endorsement is the word I was looking for.
Yeah. So with regards to Game Pass, like, do you feel like it was a positive? It seems like it's been a positive for you guys, for your studio, in terms of like getting the word out for the game. Because like, I feel like a lot of times people just dump stuff into Steam and then like they just hope for the best that someone maybe randomly grabs it or whatever. And Game Pass seems like they at least give an opportunity to lift these kind of smaller experiences and stuff like that up to, you know, give everyone a shot on it. But
yeah, I think it's really positive. Like they seem to like more experimental things. They seem to like smaller things. You know, I think it was Outer Worlds that was on there. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, this is just like Fallout, but it's short. And I was like, yeah, that's the thing. That's the move for Game Pass. Because you get to try more games, right? They like that. They like the idea that you're getting variety out of this. And if people pick it up and they don't love it, I mean, that's fine. It's great. It's no skin off their nose. And I'm just glad that they gave it a shot. But, you know, we'll never hear from those people, usually. Hmm. But if we do find somebody that picks it up and loves it, we will have a fan for life, which I think is awesome.
Yeah,
and we've started to meet those people at PAX and stuff. Like it's great.
That's a very interesting, and I wonder if that's true across developers. Like because it's included in the package, right? Because it's in the Game Pass package. Because I haven't shelled out X number of dollars explicitly for it. Are there just less negative Nancys, right? Like anybody who's unhappy just moves on. They don't start beating down your door and say, "I want my money back," right? Like whereas exactly. That probably would happen. If people had paid a flat fee for the game and didn't like it in the first 30 minutes or something.
Yep. My partner and I figured this out really early on with Netflix. Like when we started our Netflix subscription, where we started watching something and we're like, I don't like this. Let's stop watching it. And then we stopped and we went, oh, okay. We didn't rent that. We didn't pay for it. We pay a subscription fee for the chance to try it.
Right.
And there's this thing that happens where like, if you discover something, you feel a lot more proprietary about it, more excited about it. As much as we try to market the game, you know, no one's out there being like, you got to play The Big Con. It's not like, I'm trying to literally think of a video game that came out recently that has been bashed over my head. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, right? It's not like that. Where like there's a massive marketing machine pushing it into my face. It's just like people find it and they're like, I found this. I have ownership over this. I think that's really good.
Yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, like, I mean, when we played it, it was definitely a surprise for both of us. It was cool to really dive in. And I appreciate the fact that you've also talked about this, where you want to make shorter experiences, at least from my understanding, like 4 to 10 hour range is like kind of like the sweet spot.
I love that range. I love that range of game. It's such a, because again, I play a lot of stuff, right? Like I love to just be embroiled in video games forever. I mean, I just started Tears of the Kingdom, so like I like grain of salt,
yes,
obviously, but I love to play something and complete it and feel like, oh cool, and maybe I want to play it again one day,
right? And so is that kind of the mantra that you guys are following at Mighty L? Like we want to make games that are just about that sweet spot. Would you ever make a giant game that goes to like 100 hour plus game or 50 hour game? Is that something
that
you
use? I don't think I would. I don't know. I'm never say never, but like if we did, it's because we figured out a way to do that in a smart and sustainable way. Like we're not a huge team. We can't make a 100 hour game. but like you could play the Big Con for a long time. You can beat it in 4 hours. You can play it for 12.
Right.
And like I like missable content. I like having stuff in there that kind of lets the player know that we're paying attention to them. And like, hey, you did this one thing. I'm gonna give you a little something. I love that. but in general, no, we are shooting for smaller. On our next game, we're thinking a little bit about, you know, what replayability looks like, because a lot of people like to replay smaller games, as we've learned at the Big Con. I've had people go through it like 4 or 5 times in the Discord.
Just wow,
like playing
cool.
The game for the fifth time. That's the best. That's a cool feeling.
Yeah.
So I wanna find those people, and I think we know how to speak to those people. So we're gonna keep kind of making games for them.
And how many, like when you guys are working on obviously the Big Con, now that A Night in the Attic was complete, are you guys kind of working in parallel with the, like now I guess you're kind of saying you're working on something else too, so it's like is this at this point you're looking at it in terms of what's our next project, or are we kind of like everyone's kind of pitching ideas and then kind of go in that direction, whatever it was? How does that work?
We are like, that is sort of how it works when we jump to the next project, but we are like, we're not at that phase right now. We are very deep into the next project.
Okay.
And it is, and you'll probably hear about it soon. Ooh, which is very exciting.
All right.
But we also, you know, like we were actually starting, so we've got a couple things on the go that you'll get to hear about within the next year, which is great. And then we're starting to do an internal pitch now for the next thing. So there's always a need for me from a mental health standpoint to know kind of where our money is coming from and what the team is going to be jumping onto when they finish it. So I think we've solved that for the next game, and then we're figuring out what the future holds. Okay.
That's good, because I would be very nervous to like you do a great job on the one game and you have no plan for the next thing, and then it's like, okay, what do we do now? And then you're in a room throwing darts at a board and nothing's sticking, and you're like, that could spiral out of control real fast.
Yeah, there is a convenience of this being a, you know, a sole director and owner. Like at the end of the day, I can make a call and say we're doing this. And the team is, you know, I do my best to listen to them and encourage them to bring in ideas once we've pitched an idea. And I ask them, you know, of these things, what would you prefer? But at the end of the day, like we need, like they want to work, and I want to make video games more than anything. So if we ever got in this place where we were stuck, I could just say, hey, we got to make this game. And they'd be like, okay. And they know that I have values that I'm going to try to uphold, and that they can trust me to, like, I'm not gonna be like, hey everybody, we got to make the game where you kill people with a chain gun. Like I'm not gonna do that, because I don't want to do it. So I think there's some good trust there.
Okay, so that game is never coming out,
not from us.
dang it. That would be great. No, I'm kidding. Obviously,
it'd be the big pivot when you see that come from us. Like something went wrong. Something happened.
Yeah. Oh man. So with like game development, it's like, what are some, like, is there any like interesting anecdotes that you guys have like kind of, you know, during the process of making this game or Night in the Attic. I don't have a VR apparatus of like a Meta Quest or whatnot, but so I haven't had a chance to try Night in the Attic, but I've heard good things. Obviously you guys won an award for it. Congrats on
thank
that.
You. Yes, thank you.
But yeah, I'm just curious like what that was like, because like, I mean, that's a bit of a pivot too, right? Going from like a point huge and click pivot. Or adventure game to a VR game. So where did that
huge pivot. I wanted to know what we were working on next, and my tech director and another designer in Toronto let me sort of pitch that idea around, and you know, they retained kind of part ownership of it, and I was like, let us make this game, and because it was a really good idea. It was actually the demo for it that I played for them was the thing that got me into VR, which really is the best. I was like, oh, this is very cool, let's make this video game, and then we got to, and I love it so much. A lot of the best parts of our like tech foundation and our design foundation, I'm realizing, are stuff that we learned that carry over from project to project. Mm-hmm. So we're learning a lot of stuff about like, well, how do you actually make the structure of a game? How do you work on it? Like, how do you prototype it? Like, we're kind of getting better at that over time. I don't know if we'd be better at it if we weren't a remote studio, but like, we're learning step by step on how to work together. And that's kind of great. You know, it's a good feeling. And we're getting better. We're getting like some good, solid technical and like design foundations out of how we work. And it makes me happy. I'm trying to think of any like really interesting translatable stuff. But you know, I mean, you're not the only person that doesn't have a VR headset, unfortunately. which is, you know, that's life, but we got to make something that's like really special and interesting. And I got to pare my role down on that to like executive producer running out looking for money and like writer. And that was my whole, that was my whole job on that game, which was great. Nice. I got to just like disappear into the corner for a while and let George and Andrea like run the game and make something really special. Okay,
cool. I guess that's something that being a smaller studio, I'm sure you have that. I'm going to call it a luxury, but like, that you have the freedom to decide what it is that you're going to do, you know, instead of somebody telling you what you're going to do.
Yeah, like we're very lucky that we haven't, you know, we haven't done any, that's what I'm looking for. We haven't done any work for hire stuff. We're not a service studio. Like we're very lucky to be able to work on like games that we design and build. And you know, no shade to everybody that like is out there, you know, making games so that they can survive no matter what they're doing or who they're doing it for. It's great. We've just been, you know, we're fortunate. And I mean, we have that fortune because we, you know, we live in a place where we can have access to like government funding for stuff like this. Like I pitch for a lot of grants. We get a lot of grant support, which is awesome. And it lets us take weirder bets and be a little stranger about how we work. And I love that.
Take more risks, take more chances.
Exactly.
I mean, it's we've seen a lot of games coming from like from Canada and stuff like that, and the Ontario funding. So that, I mean, I know you touched on this earlier in the episode here, but and so do you guys have to like constantly pitch like yearly for that, like for these grants, or how does that work?
We do it on a project basis. So if our project takes 2 years, then we kind of go back in after that. And like, you know, there's arguments against it that like you are kind of stuck in a treadmill if you look at it one way, because they don't necessarily publish or promote things, but they also let you kind of make the thing that you need to make, and the federal level grant you need to repay to a certain degree, but it's very forgiving. Mm-hmm. And the provincial level grant you don't, but you just have to hire people in Ontario, which I was going to do anyways, which is great. So you know, there's give and take here, and there's a good argument for working with publishers on stuff too, but then you know, you have to deal with publishers, and that can not be everybody's cup of tea all the time,
right?
And I really see us kind of doing a mix of both in the future. One of the two things that we will announce is sort of publisher connected, and it's a really good relationship. It's going really well.
Cool.
I would work with them again, like that kind of stuff is awesome. And but like the other thing that we'll announce is not, it's you know, government funded, and it'll come in, we are self-publishing it, and it's gonna be one of the coolest things we've ever made. You know, nice. Both games are gonna blow your socks off, but I'm really excited.
Okay, and one coming out this year.
This is a weird year. Nothing is coming out this year.
Okay.
We've had like a good launch every single year for, you know, since the Big Con came out. We did the Switch right after. We did Night in the Attic. We did Sony last year as well for Big Con. And this year is a big pause. We're doing nothing, which is okay. Stressful, let me tell you. But it's fun. We'll like, I don't know. I'm like, how cagey can I be here? Before the end of the summer, you're 100% going to hear about our next game.
Okay, fair enough. Cool.
Just a couple little things. We talked about the saving the game earlier and the floppy disks. I love that you guys put in like, this is a floppy disk and this is what it does. Because Chris and I talked about it on the episode where it's like, yeah, these are icons that to us are like obvious what they are, but you know, they float around there on programs and things. And if you weren't our age group, you have no idea what it's just, that's what save looks like, right? This weird kind of square rectangle shape.
Yeah. Like before you had space to, you know, save things on your own hard drive, like you would have to use these stiff, hard disks that were only called floppy disks because their predecessor were actually floppy. And were much larger. Man, those 5-inch floppy disks, they were huge. Fascinating. What a fascinating time in history. I got really obsessed with the, like, because we were making a game about the 90s about a video store and about, like, you know, dead media in a way. And I got really fascinated with, like, the skeuomorphic design of, like, this is a disk and this is what you save on. And there are people that have no idea what that is and never will. And there might come a time where that icon changes, which is fascinating to me. And it also might never change and people might not know why, which is also fascinating. You look at iconography and people are like, you know, person walking through a door, that's going to stay like that forever. It means leave through the door.
Yeah.
But the save icon is no referent anymore. So we wanted to make a joke about it from the get-go. It was the only logical save icon that we could use.
I mean, you do start to, I've noticed now the quick save icons now are like, you know, spinning wheels and or whatnot. So it is, you're right. Like I've noticed it's starting to fade out and it's, I'm glad that you did bring it back. You're like, hey, just hold that thought for a second.
So. It wouldn't super work, but I should just use the exact same opening for the next game. And just be like, it's a floppy disk. We used to save information on it back in the day.
Yeah, totally. All right, cool. So for our listeners, are there like any parting thoughts for you in terms of people wanting to get into game development? Because, you know, this is always something that, you know, people are always like, hey, how hard is it to make a game? And it's like, well, there's a challenge. There's definitely a challenge.
It's tough, but it's not impossible because I can do it. And 10 years ago, that was absolutely not true. And now it is a thing that I do every single day, except the weekends where I do podcast interviews.
There you go.
Like the best advice to anyone that wants to make a game is to make a game, which is maybe not helpful, but like actually figure out what it means for you to make a game. And when you're sitting there and you're thinking, man, I got this idea for a 37,000 hour third person action RPG with like a crafting system, and like you're not going to make that game. You are 100% not going to make that game. You're going to make something much smaller. And tying yourself to a thing that exists because that's what you think it has to look like is actually going to just hurt. It's going to limit you in a lot of ways. Figure out what the idea that you want to get across is and try to make it on paper. Try to demonstrate what it feels like to do it on paper. And if it's interesting, then you can actually figure out how to code it and how to code it simply and how to make it simple. Like if you watch, there's a GDC talk about the design of Breath of the Wild. And they did like, they did a full 2D Zelda prototype of the map and stuff. And like that's one of the biggest game companies in the world. Arguably, you know, one of the most design focused game companies in the world. And they know to make it look like trash to make sure that it's fun. That's the important. Make something bad. Make something quick. Make something, you know, the quicker you can figure out if it's good, the better you'll know if it's good.
Okay. Do you find that having tools like these game engines and things that are available out there, is that a help or is that kind of a hindrance because it does kind of lock you into using kind of a specific way of building a game?
Yeah, I think I think like the engines are I think a necessity. Like I think it's a super powerful thing that is amazing. A lot of games that are in Unreal, you know, it's really easy to use the tools that Unreal has created, which makes you make games that are like games that are made with Unreal, right? Like that's a thing that kind of happens, not universally. There's a lot of really interesting stuff made with that engine, but if you, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right?
Right.
So I think the engine is really good to execute once you know what the vision is. But like, you don't need to be making The Witcher 4. You just need to be making like your personal little thing that you think is interesting. And once you see how to make it the simplest way possible, then you can use the engine. You know, I wouldn't spend more than a month on your first game, and then you just let it go. Just put it out there, then work on the sequel, work on something else, work on anything else, but just make something fast, make something fun. Use an engine if you want to, don't, doesn't ultimately matter, because as long as you're making games, you're making games.
Cool. All right, well, Dave, thank you so much again for taking the time on your weekend during your chili making to sit down and talk to us. This is really fun and really enlightening about yourself and the studio and game development. Any parting thoughts or, you know, anything you want to plug before we end?
Yeah, I mean, play the Big Con. Join our Discord. Mighty L is the Discord. I think, like, I don't know, get in touch with us however you want to. Tell us what the game meant to you. If you don't like it, you can also say that. But like I said, we don't usually hear from you if you don't like it. That's not a traditional interaction. But I'll happily take feedback. It's fine. And I don't know. Just, we're going to keep making weird stuff that has like interesting nonviolent actions, and I'm just really excited for you to see what comes up next.
Awesome. We're excited to hear about it.
Definitely very excited. And hey, if you can get Rockapella again, that'd be awesome.
Let me just get them on the phone.
That'd be amazing. Oh man, like if you could use them as like your voicemail thing, that'd be awesome.
Oh, that would be a thing that I should have done 3 years ago.
Oh man.
So well, I have you.
Yeah. Oh wow. So again, thank you so much, Dave. And we are super excited for all of the new stuff that you guys will be working on and releasing. And yeah, everyone check out the Big Con on Game Pass and on the Epic Game Store now too. So
yeah.
So check that all out, and we will that's it for this episode. So thanks everyone for listening, and maybe we'll do another one.
Thank you both so much. We really appreciate it.